Good morning, everybody. So glad that you're here with us today. My name is Holly Barreto. I'm the chair of the Adult Education Committee, and I'm delighted to welcome Kyle Christofalo here with us today. He is starting our series on peace building in the Holy Land. Kyle's going to be talking to us today, giving us an introduction to Israel and Palestine today. Kyle serves as the Senior Director of Advocacy and Government Relations for Churches for Middle East Peace. Kyle holds a BA in Peace and Conflict Studies from Messiah College and a Master of Divinity degree from Emory University's Candler School of Theology. He was first introduced to Middle East advocacy work during a semester abroad in Cairo. After graduating from college, Kyle spent 10 months serving with the Mennonite Central Committee in Bethlehem, Palestine. And most recently, he served as the Program Assistant for Middle East Policy at the Friends Committee on Legislation, where he helped coordinate lobbying work on Middle East policy. So Kyle comes to us with a wealth of experience and knowledge to share, and we're so glad you're here today. Thank you for coming. I'll open us in a word of prayer before handing it over to Kyle. Gracious God, thank you for this day. Thank you for bringing Kyle here safely to be with our congregation. We ask that you be with us this morning, that you open our ears and our hearts to what Kyle has to share with us. Bless our time together. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen. So Kyle's going to speak, and then I do think we'll have some time for questions at the end.
Thank you very much. Really grateful to be with you all this morning, and just for the hospitality of this congregation up to this point. Had a very nice night at the Nassau Inn and was able to walk a little bit around Princeton. I don't know if the echo is this okay for folks. Okay. Yeah, I actually grew up in Westchester County, New York, but have never made it to this part of New Jersey. So grateful to be here and grateful to Tom for the years that he was our connection to this congregation, and now to Lena, who has arranged this three-part series. Not included in my bio is that I'm Presbyterian, so it's always nice to be here with the Presbyterian congregation. And this is the first of three in a series. I've helped a little bit with adult education at the church that I go to, New York Avenue, and I know that the first of a series is always important because it sets the tone. Please come back for the second and third week, even if this is not the best. I know, just a little self-deprecation to start, because we really, Lena's been working hard, and we really do have an excellent lineup. Next week, you'll be hearing via Zoom from some of our partners on the ground in Israel and Palestine, and then the concluding week of the series will be with our executive director, the Reverend Dr. Maëlys Cannon, who will present a bit more on different components of advocacy and how you can sort of take what you've heard over the preceding 2 weeks into the future. So I'm going to try to leave time for questions, and I have the fun task of kind of giving a very quick and brief overview of an area that is quite complex and a history that is quite complex. So just a note, this is not going to be an in-depth history, but we'll give you some of the key sort of points from the past 100 or so years that, again, will provide some context for what we're seeing happening right now. So for those of you who are not familiar with Churches for Middle East Peace, we're a coalition of 34 national Christian denominations and organizations that spread across the spectrum of U.S. Christianity. So most of the mainline Protestant denominations. The Peace USA was a founding member and continues to be an active part of our board. Evangelical, Orthodox, Catholic. So we have a wide spectrum of churches that are engaged in our work. The denominations themselves are the members, but then we also have relationships with individual congregations across the U.S. And our goal is really to be encouraging U.S. policies that will actively promote just, lasting, and comprehensive resolutions to conflicts in the Middle East, with a particular attention on Israel-Palestine. So we have three primary ways that we do our work. Educate, this is part of that, right? Letting U.S. Christians primarily, though we of course work closely with Muslim, Jewish, and people of no faith, but letting folks know what's happening right now. elevating the voices of peace builders on the ground. So next week, you'll be able to experience that, where you'll hear directly from our partner, from some of our partners in Israel and Palestine, and then advocate. That's where I spend most of my time. We are a 501c3, so we're not a lobbying group, but we're advocating, you know, in a citizen's way to encourage, again, these U.S. policies that will help promote a lasting end to conflicts. And our executive director in her series, in 2 weeks, we'll go over some of the different parts of what advocacy is. It's not just political. There's spiritual advocacy. There's consumer advocacy. So she'll break down a little bit more of the different sort of types of advocacy that we focus on. Just because I am the government relations person, I will briefly say the three priorities that we're working on. Holistic peace building. Again, what does it look like to have, in the context of Israel-Palestine, a solution that results in flourishing for all humans, for all who live there and all who call it home. So within that, we also do work around the sustainability of the Christian community in the Middle East, which is a vulnerable community, but of course, incredibly important to our history as Christians. Second is humanitarian and economic assistance. We're not implementers. We don't have, you know, programs on the ground where we provide humanitarian support, but encouraging the U.S. government to continue to provide humanitarian support through funding. And then third is human rights issues, and we'll get into a little bit of some of the human rights issues that we're focusing on at the end of the presentation. I should also note that, you know, I'm trying to have time at the end for questions. If there's a burning question that you have in the middle and you want to ask it, we can possibly entertain that. I know that you'll need to be mic'd up, though. So try to wait until the end, but if something is really burning, you can ask in the middle. So to start, we do need to go back about 100 plus years. At the turn of the 20th century, the land that we are talking about today was called Palestine. In 1922, so toward the start, in the earlier start of the British Mandate of Palestine, there were about 660,000 Arabs and 84,000 Jews. Palestinian Arabs then were the majority, while Jews who would have at that time spoken Arabic had always maintained a presence in the land. You know, before the British Mandate, it was controlled by the Ottoman Empire. So one thing that you might have heard, or you will hear in some conversations as the Jewish Zionist movement was starting, a land without a people for a people without a land. But there were definitely people that were in that land. So Jewish Zionism developed, you know, starting in the late 1800s, well before the Holocaust, but would obviously accelerate in the World War eras. Many Jews would not have imagined leaving their homes in Europe, but as anti-Semitism intensified, that became more of a desire for them. Between 1914 and 1918, there would be contradictory promises to both Arab and Jewish leaders about that land. The Ottoman Empire ended in 1917, and then, as I said, and you see up here, the British Mandate begins. You might have heard of the Balfour Declaration, and that was made by Lord Balfour on behalf of the British government, and it set the stage for much of what we are dealing with today. The Balfour Declaration gives British backing for a national home for the Jewish people, but also indicated that it should not prejudice existing non-Jewish communities, in this case, now the Palestinian Arabs. So after, you know, in this period of 1917 to 1947, we do see immigration by a Jewish population accelerate in light of what's happening in Europe. We see beginnings of unrest between the Jewish and Arab population and violence, with some efforts by the British to envision a Jewish and Arab state side by side. But in the end, the Brits give up, and we go to our next slide, and this is 1947 to 1949. So the Brits kind of withdraw as the primary controllers of that area, so we're dealing a lot with European colonialism, and of course, the U.S. is also a part of this, and so it punts then to the United Nations. Now, at this point, Arabs make up about 67% of the population, with the Jewish population just over 33%. The UN comes together to try to divide up this land, and they come up with the UN partition plan that would give the Jewish population over 60% of the land and the rest for the Arab population. So the map that has the yellow, you can see, is what the UN suggested. And the Jewish population, more or less, is happy with this. You know, they're getting quite a bit of land relevant to their population. And overall, the Arab population is not happy with this, and they reject it. It does pass at the UN, and then immediately war breaks out. So in 1948, you have what the Israelis would call the War of Independence. They are successful against the neighboring Arab countries, and you have Palestinians who call that war the Nakba, which is Arabic for catastrophe. And for the Arab population, it really was a catastrophe. Much of their land was seized, villages were destroyed, you had many that were killed. We have about 750,000 at that point Palestinians who become refugees and are spread across the region, as well as US, the West. A lot of Christian Palestinians leave. There were Christian villages that were destroyed as a result of the independence, Israelis' independence war, and so that sort of course, is an integral part of the story for today. So on the left, as I said, you can see the UN partition plan, and on the right is what happens as a result of Israel's successful war in 1948, where they do actually end up getting more land than they would have if the UN partition plan had moved forward. Just about 78% of the land at that point would go to Israel, with 22 going to the Arab state. Jordan at that point had parts of the West Bank, and Egypt would have had the Sinai. So there was no Palestinian state or Arab state that was created. We're going to fast forward a bit to 1967, which is the next sort of big date that we see, and that is the Six-Day War, where Israel takes control of the Sinai Peninsula, which Egypt, as I said, had controlled from 1948 to that point, the Golan Heights in Syria, and the West Bank and Gaza. And this marks the beginning of what we would call the occupation of the West Bank, Gaza, the Golan Heights, and East Jerusalem. This is also where you see the beginning of Israel beginning building settlements on Palestinian land in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. Just gonna pause for some water. So like I said, this is a crash course, so a lot happened in the intervening years, but because of our limited time, we're going to go to the 80s and 90s. Where we see the first intifada. In Arabic, it translates to shaking off. Obviously, you know, the intervening years had a lot of political instability. It was the increase of settlements, Palestinians dealing with a military occupation. So they start to respond. And in the 80s, we see the first coordinated response in this intifada. The first intifada is largely nonviolent and does bring more attention to the situation and sympathy toward the Palestinian accords, and does lead to Israelis and Palestinians signing the Oslo Accords in 1993. The Oslo Accords were meant to be temporary and moving toward what then would be a final agreement for the land. So the Oslo Accords were always meant to be temporary. I like to start, and I forgot, but how many of you have traveled to Israel-Palestine? Okay, so largely a group that is at least familiar to some extent with the area. So as part of the Oslo Accords, you have the breaking up of Palestinian land into areas A, B, and C, which has the Palestinians had full control of, to an extent, it's still a military occupation, but full control of areas A for both administrative and police. That makes up about 18% of the Palestinian land. Area B has Palestinian administrative control, but Israeli security, that's about 22% of land. Most of the Palestinians live within areas A and B, and then area C has the largest swath of land, over 60%, but the least amount of Palestinians that live there. So this was meant to be temporary and lead to a two-state solution, but we are still in the Oslo period, essentially. So 2000s, we see the next intifada, which was not largely nonviolent. So the Camp David peace process had broken down in July of 2000, and the moment that many analysts will say sort of sparked the second intifada was then Prime Minister Ariel Sharon visiting the Temple Mount. Now, this is where the Haram al-Sharif Mosque is. It's a complicated issue, but actually for most religious Jews, the leading religious scholars and clerics within Israel will say that it's inappropriate for Jews to actually go to the Temple Mount because of how holy it is. And it's a lot of the restrictions on Jews going to the Temple Mount actually come from within the Jewish faith, but it's also a contentious issue, and Palestinians and Muslims and Arabs in the area would definitely see visiting of the Temple Mount by an Israeli leader as a provocation. And so this led to the start of the Second Intifada. I know many of you, it didn't make media here, so you might remember seeing on the news the various suicide bombings that were really targeting, in this case, civilians. And while Israel engaged in air and tank attacks with, they were, of course, the stronger military presence. And so in this period, we see 3,000 Palestinians die and 1,000 Israelis were killed. So that's all of the history, right? No, but that's the history that we'll do for today. This, and we can share some of these slides if you're interested. I know it goes by quickly, but this gives sort of land of Palestine from 1917 to 2020, with showing sort of who controls the land in those particular years. So that lay, oh, yep. Oh, sorry. Okay.
What is the population shift? You marched it all the way up to 49.
Yeah.
Since then, how's the population?
Yeah, we'll get to that.
Okay.
Yeah. We will get to that. So realities on the ground, again, my former caveat applies here too. We're not going to hit on every issue that's occurring at the moment, but some of the top sort of realities on the ground. As a result, from the Israeli perspective, as a result of the Second Intifada, there was the desire to build more security. And so what we saw was, this is again how the Israeli government would explain it, but the construction of a separation barrier that was supposed to separate the West Bank from Israel proper, whether or not it does that, you know, we can have a conversation. But construction began in 2002, so in that period of the Second Intifada. It's not finished yet, the construction. When it is done, it will be 708 kilometers long when fully completed. And the last statistics that we have, about 440 kilometers are completed at present. That's from B'Tselem, which is an Israeli human rights group. Nearly 12% of all of the land in the West Bank is either to the west of the barrier or completely enclosed by it. So there are Palestinian communities that are shut off from each other as a result of the wall, and it's about 100 feet tall. And if you have been there since 2002, I'm sure you have experienced, seen the wall on the Palestinian side has a lot of graffiti. You know, we don't have to get into all of the politics and denominational issues, but I will say that as a result of some of the PCUSA actions at the General Assembly, I've been there and seen with myself sometimes, "Thank you, PCUSA," written on, graffitied on the wall after some of the actions of the General Assembly. But you'll see a constant slate of graffiti make its way on that wall. So it's used by Palestinians to express themselves. So settlements, we talked a little bit about it before. But one of the ways to deal with the expanding population of Israelis has been for the Israeli government to build settlements within the West Bank and East Jerusalem. So there's about 3 million Palestinians overall, and living within the West Bank, East Jerusalem, and Gaza. And then you have settlers living within the West Bank as well. According to Americans for Peace Now, you have 13% of the West Bank population are settlers, but we're seeing a rise in that number. Again, it began after the war in 1967. It does violate international law. According to international law, an occupying force cannot move their population into a place that they occupy. And they're close, these numbers are rising, but close to 300 Israeli settlements with approximately 700,000 Israeli citizens. So if you're an Israeli and you live in these citizens, you have full rights as an Israeli citizen, just as if you lived in Tel Aviv or other parts of Israel proper. So as of January 1 of this year, there's a new report that says there are, using official statistics, about 503 settlers living in the West Bank. So that does not include East Jerusalem, which is also viewed by many international bodies as occupied land. So there's the remaining about 200,000 would live within East Jerusalem. So we've seen a rapid shift, acceleration in settlement growth over the past year. So just according to this latest study, more than 2.5% increase in the past 12 months and a 16% increase over the last 5 years. So settlement, the rapid expansion of settlements is something that many folks that support a two-state solution would say is making it even less likely because as more Israelis are moving into the West Bank and the settlements increase, the possibility of negotiated swaps of land or transfer of population would be increasingly challenging. The settler population was moved out of Gaza, and so there are no more Israelis living within the Gaza Strip. But from an Israeli perspective, you will hear, you know, we moved our settlers, our population out of Gaza, and what has that gotten us? They would say it hasn't brought us any closer to peace, and so there's going to be a resistance to moving settlers outside of the West Bank, given that reality. So just very quickly, for those of you who have been there maybe recently, in the West Bank, you have probably seen these water tanks that are on individuals, Palestinians' home, because there is severe restrictions on well drilling and construction of water distribution networks within the West Bank. So households that can afford it and can do it themselves will have these water sources on their homes themselves so that they can control to some extent their own water into their homes. So in some areas of the West Bank, for example, their daily water consumption per person is 25 to 30 liters, while the World Health Organization recommends 120 liters per capita per day. So access to water is a significant concern throughout the West Bank and Gaza. Other humanitarian concerns that we're tracking around food insecurity. So this is from the World Food Program. More than 27%, 1.6 million people of Palestinian suffer from food insecurity. One in two people in Gaza are food insecure, and one in three people in Gaza are in need of immediate food assistance. So that is the history. Of course, there's a lot more to go over, the history and the current events. There has been a lot happening in the past 10 to 15 days, and there is now a new Israeli government. So I want to do a few minutes on sort of what we've been seeing most recently and then have time for some questions. So January 26th, Israel forces conducted a raid on the Jenin refugee camp in the north of the West Bank. So their stated reasoning for doing so was that there were militia members who were planning an attack against Israelis in Jenin. So that was their stated purpose. They fired to find those militants. They fired live ammunition, killing nine Palestinians, including an elderly woman and two minors aged 17 and 16. Over 20 people were reportedly injured. As I said before, the objective from the Israeli perspective was to counter a planned terrorist attack and arrest three militants. The following day, seven individuals, I'm sure many of you saw on the news, were killed by a Palestinian gunman in the Jerusalem neighborhood of Nev Yaakov. The gunman was 21-year-old, and the shooting occurred outside of a synagogue where bystanders in the immediate area were targeted. So five victims were declared dead at the scene. And then two died in the hospitals afterward. The gunman fled the scene, and he was eventually killed by the Israeli police. After this, I think it's important to note that Israel detained 42 suspected individuals who were deemed to be in connection with the attack. The majority of them, though, were acquaintances or friends of the shooter. It is not believed that this was an elaborate plan with that many people involved, but this is something that Palestinians, especially those who are family or close associates of someone who does plan out an attack like this, where they're often targeted and then arrested, most were discharged the following day, though some do still remain in custody. The next day in East Jerusalem, neighborhood of Silwan, a 13-year-old Palestinian boy shot father and son who were badly wounded but are still alive. And then Israeli police raided the boy's home and arrested his parents and other family members. So just as of the beginning of, as of this year, 2023, we've seen seven Israelis killed in that one attack on the 27th, and then 35 Palestinians have been killed by Israeli forces since the beginning of the year. So it's already shaping up to be an incredibly violent and deadly year. 2022 was in the West Bank the deadliest year against Palestinians that we had seen in quite some time. And unfortunately, the trend looks like we're shaping up that this year might take that as well. So briefly, we are in a new Israeli government. On December 29th of last year, the Israeli parliament, the Knesset, ratified the new government under Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. He is now in his sixth non-consecutive term as prime minister. He was ousted. Again, it's been somewhat over the news, but over the past year or two, Israel's had five or so elections because theirs is a parliamentary system, and there's 120 seats overall, so you need more than half of that to be selected as prime minister, and the coalition has been quite tenuous, to say the least, over the past 2 years, and so we've seen a number of elections, and now Netanyahu is back in power. Many view this as the most far-right, nationalist, and religiously conservative cabinet. Netanyahu felt the only way probably that he could get to the number that he needed was to assemble a pretty right-wing government. So we'll see some of the members. This is the full new Israeli government. Some of the members of note. I should say that there has also been, and it's reached our news, government protests within Israel in reaction to this new far right wing government. It does not generally, the protests themselves are generally not about treatment of the Palestinians, but more so some of the legal changes that this new government is trying to make. So they feel that it will erode the Israeli democracy around how judges are appointed, as well as the potential for the cabinet to actually veto Supreme Court decisions through passing legislation. So it's entering now its fifth week of consecutive protests, seeing tens of thousands of Israelis in Tel Aviv and smaller groups in other parts of the city. There are some protesters that also discuss the issue related to Palestine, but for the most part, the protests are again relating to Israel's court system and the challenges from this new government to that. So here are just a few of the ministers in this new government that hold positions that will involve engaging with the Palestinians, to put it lightly. So you have the National Security Minister. His last name is Ben-Gavir. He also now has control over the entire Israeli police force. He he lives in a West Bank settlement. He's the leader of the far right Otzmat Yehut, Jewish Power Party. In 2007, he was actually convicted in a Jerusalem court for incitement of racism and terrorism against Arabs. He often shows up to some of the protests with gun. This was before he was installed in this position. So he'll have control over the Israeli police, and we've already heard some of how the Israeli police have been involved in killings of Palestinians just this year. So we also have Smotrich, who is the finance minister, and they've changed, again, in order for Netanyahu to get in power, he had to make a number of concessions, and one of that was to, within the finance minister's portfolio, also include a role within the defense ministry to oversee Israeli settlements in the West Bank. Their expansion and annexation is a desired goal. He has also been outspoken, and we've seen this in some of the responses from the U.S. Both Ben-Gavir and Smotrich in anti-LGBTQ advocacy. And so that has prompted the U.S. government to respond, to affirm that they are not in agreement with those positions. So he leads the Religious Zionist Party. He is a current member of the Knesset, and in 2005 was arrested by the Israeli Shin Bet for suspected terrorism during the Israeli disengagement from Gaza. I'm going to skip over this for time. The last one is Orit Struck. She was in the Knesset in 2013 and is a leader in opposing the recognition of non-Orthodox Jewish movements within Israel. She, in her portfolio, she will also have leadership over settlement expansion, and she was just in a meeting with settlement leaders in the West Bank where she conveyed the government's plan over the next 2 years to add 100,000 settlers to be relocated within the West Bank. So that's just some of the new members of the Israeli government, and I'm going to stop there because I'm sure you're tired of hearing me speak, and if there are any questions.
Thank you so much. Back to the beginning. Mm-hmm. It seems to me that the United Nations partition was rather generous. Why did the Israelis start a war right after that?
So the Israelis didn't start the war. It was the Arabs. Sorry, I should have specified. The Israelis were fine, or the Jew, you know, at that point it wasn't Israeli. But the Jewish population was fine with it. I'm sure there were some that maybe wanted more, but it was the surrounding Arab countries and the Arabs that lived in the British Mandate Palestine that started.
So is it the goal of the Israeli government? I mean, what they would like is to have no Palestinians at all?
Yeah, well, I mean, obviously I can't speak on behalf of the Israeli government. Certainly there have been some of these far-right Israeli leaders that have expressed sentiments along that regard of wanting to get rid of the Arab population. There are those within the Israeli government that hold different views, that are, you know, supportive of extending rights to the Palestinians, but overall, the Israeli government certainly doesn't want Palestinians to have, you know, equal citizenship within an Israel proper. That I think is pretty clear. But I don't want to prescribe intent to all of the Israeli government.
Mm-hmm. So I have two questions. The first one is, what's the population, Israeli versus Palestinian, mm-hmm. overall? And the second is, would I be correct to assume that drilling for water in Israeli settlements is not forbidden?
Yes. To answer the second question first, it is permitted. Many Israeli settlements will have fountains in them, swimming pools. There is no lack of access to water within the settlements. And I want to look up after this the exact statistics for population, so I will get back to you. I know there's about 3 million Palestinians, but I want to look up the exact Israeli population, so I will find you after. Yeah.
Thank you so much. I was wondering, with the slide about the new finance minister,
yes,
it mentioned that his fiscal policies will be heavily structured around Jewish biblical principles, mm-hmm. which what comes to me to mind for me in the Hebrew scriptures are things around jubilee, of forgiving debt, of not taking interest. Mm-hmm. I'm curious if that's what, if you can give some examples,
yeah.
because those, the examples coming to mind
or positive, yes, in your perspective.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. I don't believe that they are in that alignment, but again, I am not, you know, we follow more closely the U.S. government, so I'd have to look a little bit more into that, but I can, after, we can talk. Sorry to, I don't want to say anything that's not accurate. Well, if you're still thinking of questions, I'm giving a shout out again to Lena, who is our conduit between CMEP and this congregation. So if you have follow-up questions, you know, Lena knows how to get into contact with us as well. We still do have time. I just wanted to make sure I had that shout out.
Yeah, just a quick question about going back to the water issue. Do these tanks that some of the Palestinians build on their houses, is that just to catch rainwater, or is there some other way of getting water?
There's other ways of getting water, but now I feel like a broken record of not being an irrigation expert. I don't know if Tom has a better intimate knowledge, but it's not just catching rainwater. No. Yeah, the water's delivered. They have to purchase the water. So it wouldn't primarily be concerned with rainwater.
The political,
hold it up to your mouth,
the political evolution in Israel, trending toward the conservative side. I mean, you've got 120 seats. You've got some Palestinian rights to vote, and in fact, Arab parties, or at least one party.
Yeah.
The trend toward more conservatism, more of these far-right groups getting ostensibly more than 50% of those seats. Why has it evolved that way? Is it simply the fear of terrorism? Is that what is driving it? We've seen it. We've seen a similar kind of thing in the United States, mm-hmm, but not to this extent.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. Within Israel, around 20% of the population is non-Jewish. So that'll be both Christian and Islamic. And so there are some parties within the Knesset that are from the Arab-Palestinian perspective. But yes, I would say, again, it's a complex issue. But in many cases, the average Israeli, as has been sort of explained to me, their principal thought is on safety and security, not wanting to go back to, you know, the 2000s where there were, you know, suicide bombings and fear for their safety. So I think the shift to the right, and you see it, I think it is unique in some senses, but the whole population is shifting rightward, and the youth are part of that. There isn't a shift where it doesn't affect the younger population. And so I think security, from their perspective, is a principal reason. You know, like I said before, there would be a prevalent thought among many Israelis that they left Gaza, left, quote unquote. They still control who gets in and out and what goods get in and out, but their population left, and has that made them any safer? No. That would be their response. So I think the rightward shift has definitely been one, you know, the security concern has been one of the principal reasons. You know, there's also not an opportunity really for Israeli and Jewish Israeli and Israeli Arabs to meet and to be together and to know each other. And so, you know, I think that contributes as well.
Kyle, thank you so much for being here. The statistics, the reports, the news headlines, they're all grim these days, particularly. Mm-hmm. Are there areas of hope, even wee little glimmers that you're seeing? Are there Israeli groups that are not trending right and trying to stay centrist and a little more balanced? Can you give us maybe some areas that you're hoping can buck this trend?
Yeah. It's always nice to end on a positive note, right? I think you certainly, the protests in Israel, like I said, have principally been around concerns about the threats to their judicial system and their democracy. But you are seeing an increasing number of protesters who are also wanting to at least shine a light on treatment of Palestinians as part of what is compelling them to protest. So we've seen that number rise a little bit over the past few weeks, and I think that is a testament to the fact that there are definitely still those within Israeli civil society that are concerned about the situation vis-a-vis the Palestinians and want to find a way forward. And so we do still see Israeli and Palestinian groups working together, trying to find ways where they can support some solution, whether that be a two-state solution or another configuration. You'll hear from some of those next week. You know, we'll hear from an Israeli and a Palestinian who are committed to that. And so, yeah, we do see hope. Of course, you know, we're chipping away. CMEP has been around. We're celebrating our 40th anniversary next year, and if we didn't believe that there wasn't a possibility, then you know I wouldn't be in this work, and I don't think my colleagues would either. And so, you do see instances of engagement and peaceful coexistence, but the trends are not going in the best direction. I'm sorry I can't point to more specifics because honestly. There's just not a lot right now, but the resolve of even a dwindling civil society within Israel committed to this issue is hopeful for us, you know, that there are still Israelis and Palestinians that are committed to seeking a future where both peoples can flourish. I think we're done. I'll be around, I'll be worshiping with you all and getting some coffee in a few minutes, so I'll be around for questions. But I think I don't want to stand between others getting coffee.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Kyle, for this really, really informative session. We appreciate it. So as Kyle said, he'll be available for some individual questions. I want to draw your attention to two tables in the back. It looks like we have signups for small groups, for our Lenten small groups starting. And also over here, there's some signup sheets. If you want to sign up to get more information from Kyle's organization, you can sign up for emails there. Thank you again, Kyle.